Hi everyone, Ryan here, and welcome to the 19th episode of The Stoic Advantage. Today I'm going to play for you an interview that I had with Jill Hassan. Jill is an educator and a writer from the United Kingdom. She specifically focuses on mindfulness as well as positive thinking. So over this period of time, I came across a book of hers called Positive Thinking Pocketbook, Little Exercises for a Happy and Successful Life. Really enjoyed the book, and I found a lot of what she said is very similar to the principles of Stoicism. So I wanted to have her on the podcast. She agreed. So I'm really excited to share with you the interview. Please remember as well, whatever platform you're on, if you can like this podcast, if you could follow it, share it on whatever social media platforms you have, that'd be great. And here's my interview with Jill Hassan. Today, I have Jill Hassan on the program. Now, Jill has over 20 years of experience as a tutor, trainer, and writer. Jill has delivered teaching and training for educational institutions, voluntary and business organizations, and the public sector. She has also written books on subjects such as positive thinking, dealing with difficult people, overcoming anxiety, mental health, and well-being in the workplace. So, Jill, thank you for accepting my invitation to come on Philosophy in Motion.
Thanks for inviting me.
Okay, so I'm going to start with a question that I often ask a lot of my guests at the beginning. When were you first introduced to personal development?
I've been thinking about this. Yeah, I suppose it was when I was in my 30s. We had young children, and I didn't have any particular skill or experience or job that I could do when the children were small. So I thought I'm going to go back to studying. And in order to do a degree at the university, I had to do a year's course before that. It's called an access course, and at a local college here. And on that course, it was very specifically aimed at study skills, helping you to get the skills you'll need to study at degree level. But also, there was a big emphasis on personal development, getting the confidence that you needed, the assertive skills that you'd need. And so that was my first sort of real introduction to sort of formal study of personal development. And I found it, I loved it and thought, whatever I do on this degree, I then went on and did a degree in social anthropology. I thought, this is what actually I want to get involved in, is personal development with people.
Oh, that's interesting. I wish we had that in Canada. I know, are you familiar with Alain de Botton?
No.
No, he's a writer from the UK. He's has a YouTube channel called The School of Life, and he emphasizes the importance
of developing an
emotional education. And I think that's, at least in Canada, what we're lacking. So it's great that you're able to take that course. So one of your job titles is a career coach. So some who are from Canada may not be familiar with what that is. So could you explain what a career coach is?
Yeah, so for me, that involves helping people to look at what their skills, strengths, interests are, what their values are, which isn't something that people think about very often. They don't often think about their values. That's what's important to them. So that could be things like truth and honesty, or adventure and fun. There's a whole range of values that if a person is doing work or involved in a career that doesn't actually accommodate their values, reflect their values, they're going to find it to be a very difficult fit. So most people that come to me for career coaching, they've already been out in the workplace for 10, 20 years, and they just want to take a different direction. They feel that maybe what they're doing isn't right for them. So I help people identify what might be a better fit for them. But also something that I'm particularly good at is researching all sorts of possibilities. So often I can come up with things that people haven't really thought about. So a bit similar to myself, actually. When I went along to a talk at the university before I did a degree, and someone gave a talk on social anthropology. I didn't even know that, I had no idea that such a thing existed. So when I heard about that, I thought, oh, that is absolutely what I want to study. That's what I want to do. So that's how I help people with career coaching, helping them uncover their skills, strengths, abilities, and pulling it all together and looking at what the possibilities might be for them. And the reason for that is the world of work and careers has changed. Years ago, certainly, you know, in the sort of in the last century, in the 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, you got a job and you expected to stay with that organization, and your career would progress pretty much through one organization. The organization sort of sorted all that out for you. You went up the hierarchy and got an increase in pay and status and everything else that came with that. Now, you can still do that, but there's a huge amount of us that have to actually work out our own paths for our careers. And it's not easy to do, not least because there are so many options and possibilities. So career coaching, that's what all career coaches do, not just myself, but they help people sort of work out what would be a good way forward.
Yeah, that's interesting. And I want to just stay briefly on this topic one more time. Do you find a common reason why people get put into careers that they're not really passionate about, why they choose certain careers early on?
I think because if you're already quite good at something, in fact, I can remember this myself. I was quite good at cooking, and I was interested in cooking and liked doing it. I had no real clear thoughts about what else I could do. So when I left school, I went on to study to work in catering. Once I'd done the course, I thought I enjoyed it, but it's not what I want to do with my life. So I went on to do different things. But I think people either feel that they've got to do what they already enjoy and they're interested in, that they've got to do it as a job, not necessarily just keep it as a sort of hobby or an interest, or they get pressure from parents and teachers to pursue a particular line of work or career, or they just fall into something through not knowing what else is available. Something comes up, they get into a job and just keep at that. They're never 100% happy with it, but it earns them a living and they just keep with it. So yeah, one of those three reasons, I think.
Yeah, interesting. And then oftentimes they may come to you after having that kind of existential crisis that, oh my goodness, I've been here for 10 years and feel like it's not doing anything for me.
That's right. Yeah, absolutely. Yes.
Yes. I want to get into your writing on positive thinking. So I have your one book here, Positive Thinking Pocketbook, which I really like. And you actually talk about reframing your perception on your job in here, which is interesting. But yeah. Can you define what positive thinking and positive action mean?
So let me start with a quote from Shakespeare, which I think I've put in the book. And he says, "For there is nothing good or bad, but thinking makes it so." Mm-hmm. So yeah, if we use a job or work or career as an example, there's no good jobs and bad jobs and careers. It's just how you think about it. So it's like positive thinking means that you recognize that for anything, any situation, you can think of it in negative ways or you can think of it in positive ways. Neither of them are sort of the absolute truth. It just depends on how you approach it. And the thing is about negative thinking, when you think about situations in negative ways, it's it's very rarely helpful to think of something in a negative way. So if you take your job, you think, I hate this job, it stinks, I don't like anyone that I work with, it's boring, it's repetitive, I've done it too long. If you stay stuck in that mode of thinking, that's all you're going to do is just be stuck. Whereas if you think to yourself, okay, so it's a job, it pays the bills at the moment, you're more likely to move on to more helpful ways of thinking, like, so what else can I do? What other opportunities might there be? What might the options be? How can I make the best out of this bad job? The job still remains the same. That doesn't change at all. But positive thinking and negative thinking all relate to how you think about it. So I often, when I'm teaching in a class, one of the places I teach is quite near a train station, which is up the hill. So I say to people, see this chair? Pick up a chair. And I say, now, if I had to carry this up the hill to the train station, I would see this chair as being a negative thing. It's heavy, and I've got to struggle up the hill carrying this chair. But of course, once I get to the top of the hill next to the train station, I can sit down on the chair, and then that chair becomes a positive thing. Mm-hmm. And yet the chair is still a chair. It hasn't changed. My thinking about it has. So positive thinking it's an option. It's not all woo-woo and pretend being unrealistic. It's recognizing that and acknowledging the negative ways of thinking about something, but it's also recognizing that there's positive ways of thinking about something, and positive ways of thinking about it are usually much more helpful.
Yeah. And what about positive action? How would you?
Positive action follows from positive thinking. So the same with anything we do. Of course, we've got automatic ways of behaving. We have routines and habits and things we just do automatically. But when we have the choice to think about what we're doing, then positive action simply follows from positive thinking. So if you think positively, you're more likely to behave and do things more positively.
Yes, exactly. I know your ideas are similar to, have you heard of the book, The Obstacle is the Way by Ryan Holiday?
No, I haven't heard of.
No, he's an American writer who is influenced heavily by Stoic philosophy, particularly Marcus Aurelius and his quote, what stands in the way becomes the way, kind of like the idea that obstacles can be reframed and thought of as opportunities for growth. And I really saw that with that chair analogy, how, yeah, we could certainly reframe our situation and that could only lead to really good things rather than being down in the dumps and, you know, not progressing well mentally.
Absolutely. And actually, you saying that has reminded me of something else, an approach that I had. So when I then did this degree, this is 25 years ago or so, when I was in my 30s, I had two young children, both at school. And, people said to me, how are you going to study when you've got, you know, you're going to do a degree and you've got kids at school? How are you going to do that? You know, that could actually, some people would see that as an obstacle. Actually, I saw it as a help rather than a hindrance, because their day helped to structure my day. The fact that they left for school at, you know, like 8:30 in the morning, or I'd take them to school, then I'd come back at 9 o'clock. I only had to attend classes 2 days a week. The rest of the time you had to study at home on your own, doing your own research and essay writing. So I saw that as, that's fantastic. That's completely structures my day. It means that I know that I'm going to have to go and leave and pick them up at 3 o'clock. Mm-hmm. So rather than it be a hindrance, it's like, this is the amount of time that I've got to do my studies. Whereas, yeah, I had a friend who was also studying at the same time at the same university. He didn't have a partner, he didn't have children, he didn't have a job. He had all the time in the world. And I'd say to him, you know, what have you been doing today? And he'd say, oh, I've been at the library, I was in the library all day. And I'd say, oh, I bet you got loads done. And he'd say, I didn't get anything done. It was so unstructured. I just got lost in looking at this and then looking at that. So, yeah, I can see that absolutely this idea of an obstacle actually being more of a help. Yeah,
And yeah, and business can, yeah, help you get things done. I know a lot of people say, oh, I hate my job and I want to start a business. So they completely quit their job and then they have all this time on their hands and they're like, what do I do? But I know there's a new approach a lot of people take. I guess they call it a side hustle, which means, you know, allocating some part of your day, a limited part of your day, and you have to force yourself to work because you know you only have 2 or 3 hours in the evening. So for sure, I think putting restraints on yourself gets you to get stuff done.
Yeah, yeah. And actually, of course, right at this time, you know, for so many people working at home, working from home, that, you know, I've read a lot about people are really struggling with that because they're having to create totally new structures to their day. And it's not so easy. It's not something that we get taught at all. I mean, you know, when we're at school, when we're kids, we, you know, our day's structured for us. We're in no situation are we encouraged to structure our own days. It's either completely structured at school or not. And then we've got weekends. So it's something people struggle with.
Yes, for sure. I'm curious about your writings on mindfulness. So how did you become drawn to mindfulness? And can you perhaps provide us with some small techniques that we could use on a regular basis to practice mindfulness?
Yeah, well, so I had always thought mindfulness was to do with meditation. The two were the same thing. And so like a lot of people, I just imagined that involved just sitting cross-legged on a beach somewhere and, you know, saying, maybe, you know, trying to clear your mind. And I dismissed that as, well, that's not something that I could ever do or be interested in. And I couldn't see the benefits. But I was doing some writing for magazines before I wrote books, and a magazine called Psychologies asked me if I would write a little bit about mindfulness. And I thought, I don't really know much about that, but yeah, okay, I can look stuff up. And I became quite intrigued by it, recognizing that there's different aspects to mindfulness, like, for example, the concept of beginner's mind, and then being non-judgmental, having patience, having acceptance and acknowledgement, all these aspects and concepts of mindfulness. So I got quite intrigued and interested and wrote some stuff for this magazine. And then about 3 or 4 years later, when I was writing books, I was talking to a publisher and I said, I've noticed that you don't have any books on mindfulness. I wasn't actually asking to write it. I just thought it was interesting that it seemed to be quite a thing and they didn't have anything on that. And they said, actually, it is something we're thinking about and we were going to ask you if you could write about it. So I thought, oh, golly, a whole book on mindfulness. I don't know. So I gave it some thought, and from what I'd already researched and written, I recognized that it was interesting that I'd always thought mindfulness wasn't for me because I thought mindfulness was just meditation. And so I thought, well, in that case, does that mean if you can't meditate, and I cannot be the only person who feels like that, if you can't sit still and clear your mind, does that mean that mindfulness passes you by, you can't access it? And I discovered that actually, no, that's not the case at all, that there's a whole range of ways that we can be more mindful that do not at all have to involve sitting and just trying to clear your mind. So I think of that as more formal mindfulness. And the type of mindfulness that I've written about is, I think of as informal mindfulness. So that's being mindful on a day-to-day basis in everything that you, well, as much as possible, everything that you do and think about and how you behave. So you asked me, is there some techniques that we can use or I use on a regular basis to practice mindfulness? I think I'd have to say that I don't know about techniques. The way I'd put it is that The two things that have had the most impact on me on writing about, when it comes to writing mindfulness, what I've learned from that is that when I'm doing stuff now, I just focus on that. It's very easy to try and multitask, to do this and think about that. And while you're thinking about that, do this, but think about that and mustn't forget about this. What I have this sort of way of like just focusing on one thing at a time. So if I'm cooking, I'm cooking. If I'm writing, I'm writing. If I'm out walking, which I do a lot of in the countryside, I go hiking with friends, then I'm just doing that. So it's the idea of focusing on one thing at a time, because if you're being mindful, if you're just focusing on what you're doing right now, if you've got other stuff to think about and do, what the quickest and easiest way to deal with that is to just write it down, write yourself a note, make a list, whatever it is, and know that you've got it out of your head and it's on paper. So just focusing on one thing at a time, I find, is really helpful mindfulness technique. It's something like we talk about practicing mindfulness, and it is something you've absolutely got to practice. You can't just think, yeah, okay, that sounds good, I'll do that, because of course you do find your mind wandering off to other things. But you just pull yourself back and go, no, I'm doing this right now, thinking about that, I can get to that after this. So focusing on one thing at a time. And then another sort of key thing for me about mindfulness relates to something that a German poet, I'm not sure if I'm going to pronounce his name right, his name is Rainer Maria Rilke, and he says, let everything happen to you, beauty and terror, just keep going, no feeling is final. And why I like that is because it relates to the mindfulness concept of the fact that all things will pass. It's true. You know, if you're having a great time, really enjoy it, because it will go on. It will pass. The enjoyable times will pass. So make the most of them now. And the bad times, like the one, you know, the world's in at the moment, that too will pass. It will pass. I'm old enough. How old am I? 62. No, I'm 60. Am I 62? Yes, I am on Sunday, actually. Yeah. I've lived long enough so far to realize that it's an absolute truth that all the things that you're going through, whether they're good or bad, nothing remains the same. So if you're suffering, it doesn't make it any easier. Suffering is suffering, but it's not going to remain like this. Things will move on. So those are the two sort of key things for me about mindfulness, is recognizing that all things will pass, and also recognizing that when something is happening and you are doing it, embrace it and focus on that fully.
Yeah, that's great. I know you've spoken, at least on YouTube, there's a video about emotional intelligence, and I'm wondering, what is emotional intelligence? I know we briefly alluded to the School of Life, which references emotional intelligence all the time, but some people may not know what is emotional intelligence, and how does one go about developing their emotional intelligence over time?
Emotional intelligence involves understanding and managing emotions, both your own and other people's. So you've got sort of four things going on there. You've got understanding your emotions, understanding other people's emotions. You've also got managing your own emotions, and you've got managing other people's emotions. So that's a lot going on. And each one, of course, informs the other. The more you have an understanding of your own emotions and can manage them, the better you can do that with other people and their emotions. And the more you understand, the more sort of insight you get into other people's emotions, it also reflects back and helps you understand your emotions. So one of the things to know about emotions, for example, is that they're made up of three, we think of emotions as feelings, but there's three aspects to emotions. There's how you physically feel. So let's say when you're angry, how you physically feel when you're angry, your thoughts, and then also your behavior as a result of all of that. So there's there's another dynamic going on there as well. How do you go about developing your emotional intelligence? I would say there's a lot you can do, but the simplest sort of steps I would say are probably starting by being curious, more curious about emotions, looking at the wide range of emotions that we all have, learning about the differences, the nuances between emotions, and maybe widening your vocabulary. So instead of saying, for example, you might think, am I angry or actually am I feeling frustrated? Am I upset or am I disappointed? It's just interesting being curious about your own emotions and then how you respond whenever whatever emotion you're feeling. I would say something that's intriguing and worth thinking more about in order to develop your own emotional intelligence is to know that all emotions have a positive intent. Might not feel like it. So it's not particularly nice to feel guilty, to feel remorse, to feel envy and jealousy, to feel angry, to feel disappointed. What's positive about that? Any of those emotions, none of them make you feel good. But all emotions are trying to communicate something to you. So if you're feeling regret, the positive message from regret is to learn from that. When we regret something, we wish we hadn't done something. Okay, so let's, rather than beat yourself up about that and say, I feel so dreadful that, you know, I should have done this, I should have done that. Instead of that, actually think, okay, so what didn't I do and what would I do differently next time? How can I learn from that? The same is pretty similar with guilt as well. If you feel you've done something wrong that's offended someone else, the whole purpose of guilt is to actually make us feel bad so that we can make amends. If we never felt guilty, we'd just go careering about behaving exactly how we wanted. So it's a sort of social control, really, in a way. That's something that I would say about developing your emotional intelligence. Be curious about emotions. Look at how you feel. Look at how other people display them. Look at the differences between emotions and then also look for, well, what's the learning here? Might not be a good emotion, but what's the positive intent? What's it trying to tell me?
Mm-hmm. I guess, could you say the same thing about if another person, let's say, lashes out on you, or I'm a teacher myself, if a student shows resentment towards me, could you say the same thing? They're trying to communicate another emotion there. It's just coming out in this way.
Absolutely. It would be like, okay, so what, you know, so for example, we get angry when we feel that we can't control a situation. So if we can control it, there's nothing to get angry about. We're in charge. It's all good. So, for example, a student might get angry with a teacher because maybe they feel, I don't understand, or they're asking me to do too much. So, and they feel like I haven't got any control over that. So they take it out on you. So actually, when you recognize that anger is about feeling that you don't have any control, and it's a way of trying to get some sort of control, then as the teacher you can go, okay, so clearly you feel like you're out of your depth here, so what is it, what's going on here, what actually are you angry about?
Interesting. Yeah. So we're living in a time right now where we're dealing with something that is not in our control. I'm curious, what advice would you give someone who is struggling with perhaps the mental effects of the coronavirus and having to stay inside?
Okay. So yeah, the two sort of key emotions that people are feeling about the current situation with the coronavirus and lockdown is they're worried, or this is what I'm hearing anyway. People are either they're worried or they're fearful, they're angry. So worry and fear are always about something that could or might happen in the future. So and we worry about how am I going to deal with this, or we're fearful about how we're going to deal with this. Well, one of the things that we're all recognizing right now is we've got no idea really what's going to happen. This will all pass without a doubt, but how and what it will be like on the other side, who knows? So we can only do what we can right now. So that's, of course, to follow all the precautions, which is wash your hands, stay inside, social distancing. So that is something we've got control over. That's great. It's not like we're unable to control what's going to happen at all. In our own lives, there are things that we can do. It's not 100% guaranteed we won't then get the coronavirus, but we can certainly manage the risks. That's brilliant. If you're worried and frightened, that's fine. Maybe allow yourself some time to be worried and frightened. 10 minutes, half an hour a day to freak out about it. And then you've really got to get a grip and go, that's enough. Now I've got to put it to one side. I've got to do something to distract myself, because there's nothing more that you can do. If you're managing the risk, doing all the right things, have some worry time and then put it to one side. Stop with the worry and do things to distract yourself. So you've got to make a list of the sort of things that you like doing and enjoy doing and do them. You've got to maybe do some of the things you don't like doing, some chores and things that you've been meaning to get around to. But also you can find new things to do. A lot of people are talking about this, that they're exploring new activities and interests. There's a ton of stuff online for free, courses and classes and free ebooks. There's absolutely loads that we can do to distract ourselves from what's going on. And then I would say aim to achieve one or two small positive things each day. Something that I did recently, there's some paint on the side of the door in our kitchen that the decorator got on there and didn't wipe off at the time. It's been there for 3 years. It annoys me every time I walk through. I finally got the sander out, sanded it off very carefully. It took 5 minutes, but it was my biggest achievement that day. So, I felt good about it. So look for a couple of small things you can do each day. They don't have to be massive things that you can achieve. Might be like trying out a new recipe, for example. You've got to cook, got to eat. So you might as well turn that into something whereby you can try a couple of new things. Doesn't matter if it goes wrong, at least you're giving it a try. You're learning something from that. And then finally, I would say something that a lot of people already do any day anyway, is at the end of each day, try and think of between one and three positive things that have happened that day, and maybe write them down. You could be thinking of those things when you're brushing your teeth, just before you get into bed. But it can be very small things. It could be like you had a funny text from a friend, or you had a good Skype or Zoom with somebody. It could be that you read something interesting. It could be that the sun was shining. Doesn't matter what it is, but it's about getting that positive thinking going again, and actually those positive neural pathways in your brain, sort of setting your brain up for being positive. So those are my sort of top tips for getting through this at the moment.
Well, that was great. And I think it really much relates to your
response on mindfulness because it allows you to be present and recognize some of these small joys that we often just take for granted. So definitely, yeah. That's great. I want to turn to more personal questions for yourself. So what books have, we asked this to a lot of people, what books have had the biggest impact on your life?
Well, I suppose there's no, I can't think of one, two, three or four single books, but I would say just the ability to read books and the fact that there are books has had a huge impact on my life because I loved reading. My dad taught me to read before I went to school. So I was about 4 years old when I started reading. And it just opens up a whole world. I've always been an avid reader. So I started with Enid Blyton books, very British adventure books when I was younger, which I loved, opened up a whole world to me that was different from my own. As a teenager, I just read everything and anything. I mean, I'm thinking Agatha Christie. I loved Agatha Christie books. Then I got into novels in the, I suppose, the 70s and 80s, things like The World According to Garp, The Thornbirds, big, super big novels that were really popular at the time. Classics like John Steinbeck's things, The Grapes of Wrath. I loved that. East of Eden. I was just a voracious reader, so anything. And I would say out of all of those books, everything, I've read hundreds and hundreds of books. I don't read novels as much, anywhere near as much now, but in my teens and 20s, absolutely read loads. I would say my favorite book is The Godfather.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Just saw the movie.
It's my favorite movie as well. And The Sopranos is my favorite TV show. So yes. I'm not Italian. On my mum's side, we're Greek. But I think it's that social anthropology thing again. It's that whole thing about cultures and the dynamics of, I'm fascinated by the dynamics of groups of people and families and communities. Mm-hmm. So I think that that book, The Sopranos, and the film and the TV series just pulls all that together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's true as well with if you've ever watched Pulp Fiction,
yes,
or the Reservoir Dogs, like
it
very much showcases how these mobster type people often have, you know, they're just like anyone else in a sense. They have their own personal life, their own personal connections. We just view them in movies as these bad killers, but they could have normal conversations like anyone else. So.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I find that dichotomy is just endlessly fascinating. Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting. What advice would you give your 25-year-old self looking back?
Well, when I got married, I was 25. I was having a great time. I lived in my husband and myself had been living in the south of France. We worked for a holiday company down there, near Saint-Tropez. Everything was great. I didn't really have any worries I can't think of any advice. I've always been quite clear about sort of next steps, what I want to do and where I want to go, and being realistic about it and making it happen. So there's nothing I would change. I don't look back to that age and think, oh, if I could only go back and tell myself not to do this or to make sure that I did that. I think I've always made the most of situations and look for opportunities. So I think I'd tell myself, well done.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's great. Yeah. I'm curious. I hope you don't mind me asking this, but I just put two and two together now. Yeah, you're a writer. And oftentimes myself or my the other host of the podcast asked writers who we have on, what does your writing process look like? when you're, let's say, writing a book or writing an article?
Yeah, it's all over the place. No one would ever be able to make any sense. A couple of years ago, I was asked if I would write a book and send a chapter at a time to the editor. And I just said, I can't do that. It's just not how I work. So the way I describe how I work is it's just like a jigsaw puzzle. I've got all these ideas, all these pieces, and the key thing is pulling it all together. So I will start, let's say I've got a book with, say, six chapters, I've got headings for six chapters. I'll put down a bunch of ideas for the first chapter, then the second, then the third, and that might be books that I want to read about it, or it might be website links, or it might be articles, or it might be ideas off the top of my head, or something someone's told me. So I'll just, each chapter will just have a whole bunch of ideas. Then I'll go back to the beginning, chapter one, and I think, okay, so what have I got here? So just like a jigsaw puzzle, like, what are all these pieces? What's going on? And I'll try and make some sense out of them. And then I'll think, oh yeah, but I could also, in that case, I could write about this in this chapter as well. And then, of course, like we all do with the internet, you go and research something and it takes you off somewhere else. So then I might find myself with a whole load more information or ideas. So it's a constant drafting and editing process. And so I never just sit down and write chapter one, chapter two, chapter three, chapter one. Nothing gets finished till the last day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. No, I know myself, thinking back to when I was in university and writing essays. Right now I'm trying to write more first person essays, but the same thing happened when I was trying to piece together an academic paper, was it just be this kind of jigsaw puzzle and having to pull and take out parts. So for sure, it's a messy process.
Yes, yeah, absolutely.
I'm curious, what is next for yourself? Do you have any projects lined up or any sort of
Writing, I'm very fortunate. My editors, my publishers are Capstone Wiley, and I've got a great editor, Annie, and along with her team, who are the marketing and publicity people as well at the publishers, we talk often about potential ideas for me to write about in the future. Right now I am writing a book about careers, which it feels a bit like, well, I don't know what sort of jobs or work or careers are going to be available in the future now. But I would say that the approach is still the same. Whatever happens once all these lockdowns finish, that with when it comes to work and jobs and careers, there's a lot that you've got to put, you've got to make the effort, you've got to put yourself out there. So a lot of what I do with career coaching, I'm sort of putting into a book to help people work stuff out for themselves about what might work for them as far as a career or a job is concerned. And thinking about things like a better work-life balance. These are the all sort of things that were coming into the fore anyway, flexible working, work-life balance. That's what I'm currently writing a book about. And I'm hoping that I'll just be able to carry on with the sort of stuff that I've been doing in the last few years anyway. I'm also a walk leader. I lead hiking holidays in Europe twice a year. Of course, there's no travel anywhere. So I'm hoping that that's what's next. I'll be able to do some more of that. I'm hoping that I'll be able to spend time with family and friends again, sort of not get back to the way things were, because I know things are going to change, but I know I am going to see my friends and family. I am going to be able to go out hiking. It just might be in different ways. So that's what's next. Just more of what I've always been doing, just waiting for the world to open up again so I can continue doing it.
For sure. Well, Joey, appreciate you coming on and sharing your experience, sharing your knowledge on positive thinking, mindfulness, and yeah, we hope to, when you eventually release that book on careers, to have you back on, because that's a topic that we're really interested here in philosophy in motion.
Cool. Okay. Well, thanks, Ryan. Been great talking with you. Thank you.
Thank you, Jill, for coming on.